The sound of feet came louder. He put his ear to the naked ice and listened. Yes, they were walking about in the hallway. There were several of them directly under him, near the trap door. He looked again to the roof on his left, wanting to run to it and hide, but was afraid. Were they coming up? He listened. But there were so many voices, he could not make out the words. He did not want them to surprise him. Whatever happened, he wanted to go down looking into the faces of those that would kill him. Finally, under the terror song of the siren, the voices came so close that he could hear words clearly.
God, but I'm tired. I'm cold. I believe we're just wasting time. Say, Jerry, you going to the roof this time?
Yeah, I'll go.
That nigger might be in New York by now.
Yeah, but we better look.
Say, did you see that brown gal in there?
The one that didn't have much on?
Yeah. Boy, she was a peach, wasn't she?
Yeah. I wonder what on earth a nigger wants to kill a white woman for when he has such good-looking women in his own race.
Boy, if she'd let me stay here, I'd give up this goddamn hunt. Come on, give a lift. You'd better hold this ladder. It seems rickety.
Okay.
Hurry up. Here comes the captain.
Bigger was set. Then he was not set. He clung to a chimney that stood a foot from the trap door. Ought he to stay flat or stand up? He stood up, pushing against the chimney, trying to merge with it. He held the gun and waited. Was the man coming up? He looked to the roof to his left. It was still empty. But if he ran to it, he might meet someone. He heard footsteps in the passage of the loft. Yes, the man was coming. He waited for the trapdoor to open. He held the gun tightly. He wondered if he was holding it too tightly, so tightly that it would go off before he wanted it to. His fingers were so cold that he could not tell how much pressure he was putting behind the trigger. Then, like a shooting star streaking across a black sky, the fearful thought came to him that maybe his fingers were frozen so stiff that he could not pull the trigger. Quickly, he felt his right hand with his left. But even that did not tell him anything. His right hand was so cold that all he felt was one cold piece of flesh touching another. He had to wait and see. He had to have faith. He had to trust himself. That was all. The trap door opened, slightly at first, then wide. He watched it, his mouth open, staring through the blur of tears which the cold wind had whipped into his eyes. The door came all the way open, cutting off his view for a moment. Then it fell back softly upon the snow. He saw the bare head of a white man, the back of the head, framed in the narrow opening, stenciled against the yellow glare of the restless bars of light. Then the head turned slightly, and Bigger saw the side of a white face. He watched the man, moving like a figure on the screen in close-up slow motion, come out of the hole and stand with his back to him, flashlight in hand. The idea took hold swiftly. Hit him. Hit him. In the head. Whether it would help or not, he did not know, and it did not matter. He had to hit this man before he turned that spot of yellow on him, and then yelled for the others. In the split second that he saw the man's head, it seemed that an hour passed. An hour filled with pain and doubt and anguish and suspense. Filled with the sharp throb of life lived upon a needle point. He lifted his left hand, caught the gun, which he held in his right, took it into the fingers of his left hand, turned it round, caught it again in his right, and held it by the barrel, all one motion, swift, silent, done in one breath, with eyes staring unblinkingly. Hit him. He lifted it high by the barrel. Yes. Hit him. His lips formed the words as he let it come down with a grunt, which was a blending of a curse, a prayer. and a groan. He felt the impact of the blow throughout the length of his arm, jarring his flesh slightly. His hand stopped in midair, at the point where the metal of the gun had met the bone of the skull. Stopped, frozen, still, as though again about to lift and descend. In the instant, almost of the blow being struck, the white man emitted something like a soft cough. His flashlight fell into the snow, a fast flick of vanishing light. The man fell away from Bigger, on his face, full length in the cushion of snow, like a man falling soundlessly in a deep dream. Bigger was aware of the clicking sound of the metal against the bone of the skull. It stayed on in his ears, faint but distinct, like a sharp bright point lingering on in front of the eyes when a light has gone out suddenly, and darkness is everywhere. He had not moved from his tracks. His right hand was still extended, upward, in midair. He lowered it, looking at the man, the sound of the metal against bone fading in his ears, like a dying whisper. The sound of the siren had stopped at some time which he did not remember. Then, it started again, and the interval in which he had not heard it seemed to hold for him some preciously hidden danger, as though for a dreadful moment he had gone to sleep at his post with an enemy near. He looked through the whirling spokes of light and saw a trapdoor open upon the roof to his left. He stood rigid, holding the gun, watching, waiting. If only the man did not see him when he came up. A head came into view. A white man climbed out of the trapdoor and stood in the snow. He flinched. Someone was crawling in the loft below him. Would he be trapped? A voice, a little afraid, called from the open hole through which the man whom he had struck had climbed.
"Jerry!"
The voice sounded clearly in spite of the siren and the clang of the fire wagons.
"Jerry!"
The voice was a little louder now. It was the man's partner. Bigger looked back to the roof to his left. The man was still standing there, flashing a light round. If he would only leave. He had to get away from this trap door here. If that man came up to see about his partner and found him sprawled in the snow, he would yell before he got a chance to hit him. He squeezed against the chimney, looking at the man on the roof to his left, holding his breath. The man turned, walked toward the trap door, and climbed through. He waited to hear the door shut. It did. Now that roof was clear. He breathed a silent prayer.
"Jerry!"
With gun in hand, Bigger crept across the roof. He came to a small mound of brick, where the upjutting ridge of the building's flat top joined that of the other. He paused and looked back. The hole was still empty. If he tried to climb over, would the man come out of the hole just in time to see him? He had to take the chance. He grabbed the ledge, hoisted himself upon it, and lay flat for a moment on the ice, then slid to the other side, rolling over. He felt snow in his face and eyes. His chest heaved. He crawled to another chimney and waited. It was so cold that he had a wild wish to merge into the icy bricks of the chimney and have it all over. He heard the voice again, this time loud, insistent.
"Jerry!"
He looked out from behind the chimney. The hole was still empty. But the next time the voice came, he knew that the man was coming out, for he could feel the tremor of the voice, as though it were next to him.
"Jerry!"
Then he saw the man's face come through. It was stuck like a piece of white pasteboard above the top of the hole, and when the man's voice sounded again, Bigger knew that he had seen his partner in the snow.
"Jerry! Say!"
Bigger lifted his gun and waited.
"Jerry?"
The man came out of the hole and stood over his partner, then scrambled in again, screaming.
"Say! Say!"
Yes. The man would spread the word. Ought he to run? Suppose he went down into the trapdoor of another roof.
No.
There would be people standing in the hallways, and they would be afraid. They would scream at the sight of him, and he would be caught. They would be glad to give him up and put an end to this terror. It would be better to run farther over the roofs. He rose. Then, just as he was about to run, he saw a head bob up in the hole. Another man came through and stood over Jerry. He was tall, and he stooped over Jerry's form and seemed to be putting his hand upon his face. Then another came through. One of the men centered his flashlight on Jerry's body, and Bigger saw one bend and roll the body over. The spotlight lit Jerry's face. One of the men ran to the sheer edge of the roof, overlooking the street. His hand went to his mouth, and Bigger heard the sound of a whistle, sharp, thin. The roar in the street died. The siren stopped, but the circling columns of yellow continued to whirl. In the peace and quiet of the sudden calm, the man yelled, "Surround the block!" Bigger heard an answering shout.
"You got a line on him? I think he's round here."
A wild yell went up. Yes. They felt that they were near him now. He heard the man's shrill whistle sounding again. It got quiet, but not so quiet as before. There were shouts of wild joy floating up.
"Send up a stretcher and a detail of men."
"Okay."
The man turned and went back to Jerry lying in the snow. Bigger heard snatches of talk.
"How do you suppose it happened? Looks like he was hit. Maybe he's about. Quick, take a look over the roof."
He saw one of the men rise and flash a light. The circling beams lit the roof to a daylight brightness, and he could see that one man held a gun. He would have to cross to other roofs before this man or others came upon him. They were suspicious and would comb every inch of space on top of these houses. On all fours, he scrambled to the next ledge and then turned and looked back. The man was still standing, throwing the spot of yellow about over the snow. Bigger grabbed the icy ledge, hoisted himself flat upon it, and slid over. He did not think now of how much strength was needed to climb and run. The fear of capture made him forget even the cold, forget even that he had no strength left. From somewhere in him, out of the depths of flesh and blood and bone, he called up energy to run and dodge with but one impulse. He had to elude these men. He was crawling to the other ledge, over the snow, on his hands and knees, when he heard the man yell,
"There he is!"
The three words made him stop. He had been listening for them all night, and when they came, he seemed to feel the sky crashing soundlessly about him. What was the use of running? Would it not be better to stop, stand up, and lift his hands high above his head and surrender?
Hell no.
He continued to crawl.
"Stop! You!"
A shot rang out, whining past his head. He rose and ran to the ledge, leaped over, ran to the next ledge, leaped over it. He darted among the chimneys so that no one could see him long enough to shoot. He looked ahead, and saw something huge and round and white looming up in the dark, a bulk rising up, sheer from the snow of the roof, and swelling in the night, glittering in the glare of the searching knives of light. Soon he would not be able to go much farther, for he would reach that point where the roof ended and dropped to the street below. He wove among the chimneys, his feet slipping and sliding over snow, keeping in mind that white, looming bulk which he had glimpsed ahead of him. Was it something that would help him? Could he get upon it, or behind it, and hold them off? He was listening, and expecting more shots as he ran, but none came. He stopped at a ledge and looked back. He saw in the lurid glare of the slashing lances of light a man stumbling over the snow. Ought he to stop and shoot?
No.
More would be coming in a moment, and he would only waste time. He had to find some place to hide, some ambush from which he could fight. He ran to another ledge, past the white looming bulk which now towered directly above him, then stopped, blinking. Deep down below was a sea of white faces, and he saw himself falling, spinning straight down into that ocean of boiling hate. He gripped the icy ledge with his fingers, thinking that if he had been running any faster, he would have gone right off the roof, hurtling four floors. Dizzily, he drew back. This was the end. There were no more roofs over which to run and dodge. He looked. The man was still coming. Bigger stood up. The siren was louder than before, and there were more shouts and screams. Yes, those in the streets knew now that the police and vigilantes had trapped him upon the roofs. He remembered the quick glimpse he had had of the white looming bulk. He looked up. Directly above him, white with snow, was a high water tank with a round flat top. There was a ladder made of iron whose slick rungs were coated with ice that gleamed like neon in the circling blades of yellow. He caught hold and climbed. He did not know where he was going. He knew only that he had to hide. He reached the top of the tank, and three shots sang past his head. He lay flat, on his stomach, in snow. He was high above the rooftops and chimneys now, and he had a wide view. A man was climbing over a nearby ledge, and beyond him was a small knot of men, their faces lit to a distinct whiteness by the swinging pencils of light. Men were coming up out of the trapdoor far in front of him and were moving toward him, dodging behind chimneys. He raised the gun, leveled it, aimed, and shot. The men stopped, but no one fell. He had missed. He shot again. No one fell. The knot of men broke up and disappeared behind ledges and chimneys. The noise in the street rose in a flood of strange joy. No doubt the sound of the pistol shots made them think that he was shot, captured, or dead. He saw a man running toward the water tank in the open. He shot again. The man ducked behind a chimney. He had missed. Perhaps his hands were too cold to shoot straight. Maybe he ought to wait until they were closer. He turned his head just in time to see a man climbing over the edge of the roof from the street side. The man was mounting a ladder, which had been hoisted up the side of the building from the ground. He leveled the gun to shoot, but the man got over and left his line of vision, disappearing under the tank. Why could he not shoot straight and fast enough? He looked in front of him and saw two men running under the tank. There were three men beneath the tank now. They were surrounding him, but they could not come for him without exposing themselves. A small black object fell near his head in the snow, hissing, shooting forth a white vapor, like a blowing plume which was carried away from him by the wind. Tear gas. With a movement of his hand, he knocked it off the tank. Another came, and he knocked it off. Two more came, and he shoved them off. The wind blew strong from the lake. It carried the gas away from his eyes and nose. He heard a man yell, "Stop it! The wind's blowing it away! He's throwing them back!" The bedlam in the street rose higher. More men climbed through trapdoors to the roof. He wanted to shoot, but remembered that he had but three bullets left. He would shoot when they were closer, and he would save one bullet for himself. They would not take him alive. "Come on down, boy." He did not move. He lay with gun in hand, waiting. Then directly under his eyes, four white fingers caught hold of the icy edge of the water tank. He gritted his teeth and struck the white fingers with the butt of the gun. They vanished, and he heard a thud as a body landed on the snow-covered roof. He lay waiting for more attempts to climb up, but none came. "It's no use fighting, boy. You're caught. Come on down." He knew that they were afraid, and yet he knew that it would soon be over, one way or another. They would either capture or kill him. He was surprised that he was not afraid. Under it all, some part of his mind was beginning to stand aside. He was going behind his curtain, his wall, looking out with sullen stares of contempt. He was outside of himself now, looking on. He lay under a winter sky, lit with tall gleams of whirling light, hearing thirsty screams and hungry shouts, defiant, unafraid.
"Tell 'em to hurry with the hose. The nigger's armed."
What did that mean? His eyes roved, watching for a moving object to shoot at, but none appeared. He was not conscious of his body now. He could not feel himself at all. He knew only that he was lying here with a gun in his hand, surrounded by men who wanted to kill him. Then he heard a hammering noise nearby. He looked. Behind the edge of a chimney, he saw a trapdoor open.
"All right, boy,"
a hoarse voice called.
"We're giving you your last chance. Come on down."
He lay still. What was coming? He knew that they were not going to shoot, for they could not see him. Then what? And while wondering, he knew. A furious whisper of water, gleaming like silver in the bright lights, streaked above his head with vicious force, passing him high in the air and hitting the roof beyond with a thudding drone. They had turned on the water hose. The fire department had done that. They were trying to drive him into the open. The stream of water was coming from behind the chimney, where the trap door had opened, but as yet the water had not touched him. Above him, the rushing stream jerked this way and that. They were trying to reach him with it. Then the water hit him, in the side. It was like the blow of a pile driver. His breath left, and he felt a dull pain in his side that spread, engulfing him. The water was trying to push him off the tank. He gripped the edges hard, feeling his strength ebbing. His chest heaved, and he knew from the pain that throbbed in him that he would not be able to hold on much longer, with water pounding at his body like this. He felt cold, freezing. His blood turned to ice, it seemed. He gasped, his mouth open. Then the gun loosened in his fingers. He tried to grip it again, and found that he could not. The water left him. He lay gasping, spent.
"Throw that gun down, boy!"
He gritted his teeth. The icy water clutched again at his body like a giant hand. The chill of it squeezed him, like the circling coils of a monstrous boa constrictor. His arms ached. He was behind his curtain now, looking down at himself, freezing under the impact of water in sub-zero winds. Then the stream of water veered from his body.
"Throw that gun down, boy!"
He began to shake all over. He let go of the gun completely. Well, this was all. Why didn't they come for him? He gripped the edges of the tank again, digging his fingers into the snow and ice. His strength left. He gave up. He turned over on his back and looked weakly up into the sky through the high, shifting lattices of light. This was all. They could shoot him now. Why didn't they shoot? Why didn't they come for him?
"Throw that gun down, boy!"
They wanted the gun. He did not have it. He was not afraid anymore. He did not have strength enough to be.
"Throw that gun down, boy!"
"Yes. Take the gun and shoot it at them. Shoot it empty." Slowly he stretched out his hand and tried to pick up the gun. But his fingers were too stiff. Something laughed in him, cold and hard. He was laughing at himself. Why didn't they come for him? They were afraid. He rolled his eyes, looking longingly at the gun. Then, while he was looking at it, the stream of hissing silver struck it and whirled it off the tank, out of sight.
"There it is! Come on down, boy. You're through. Don't go up there,"
He might have another gun. Come on down, boy.
He was outside of it all now. He was too weak and cold to hold onto the edges of the tank any longer. He simply lay atop the tank, his mouth and eyes open, listening to the stream of water whir above him. Then the water hit him again, in the side. He felt his body sliding over the slick ice and snow. He wanted to hold on, but could not. His body teetered on the edge, his legs dangled in the air. Then he was falling. He landed on the roof, on his face, in snow, dazed. He opened his eyes and saw a circle of white faces, but he was outside of them, behind his curtain, his wall, looking on. He heard men talking, and their voices came to him from far away.
That's him, all right. Get him down to the street. The water did it. He seems half frozen. All right, get him down to the street.
He felt his body being dragged across the snow of the roof. Then he was lifted and put, feet first, into a trap door.
You got him? Yeah, let him drop on. Okay.
He dropped into rough hands inside the dark loft. They were dragging him by his feet. He closed his eyes, and his head slid along over rough planking. They struggled him through the last trap door, and he knew that he was inside of a building, for warm air was on his face. They had him by his legs again, and were dragging him down a hall, over smooth carpet. There was a short stop. Then they started down the stairs with him, his head bumping along the steps. He folded his wet arms about his head to save himself, but soon the steps had pounded his elbows and arms so hard that all of his strength left. He relaxed, feeling his head bounding painfully down the steps. He shut his eyes and tried to lose consciousness, but he still felt it, drumming like a hammer in his brain. Then it stopped. He was near the street. He could hear shouts and screams coming to him like the roar of water. He was in the street now, being dragged over snow. His feet were up in the air, grasped by strong hands.
Kill him! Lynch him! The black son of a bitch!
They let go of his feet. He was in the snow, lying flat on his back. Round him surged a sea of noise. He opened his eyes a little and saw an array of faces, white and looming.
Kill that black ape!
Two men stretched his arms out, as though about to crucify him. They placed a foot on each of his wrists, making them sink deep down in the snow. His eyes closed, slowly, and he was swallowed in darkness.
This ends Disc 9. Native Son, Disc 10.
Book 3. Fate. There was no day for him now, and there was no night. There was but a long stretch of time, a long stretch of time that was very short, and then, the end. Toward no one in the world did he feel any fear now, for he knew that fear was useless. And toward no one in the world did he feel any hate now, for he knew that hate would not help him. Though they carried him from one police station to another, though they threatened him, persuaded him, bullied him, and stormed at him, he steadfastly refused to speak. Most of the time he sat with bowed head, staring at the floor, or he lay full length upon his stomach, his face buried in the crook of an elbow, just as he lay now upon a cot, with the pale yellow sunshine of a February sky falling obliquely upon him, through the cold steel bars of the 11th Street police station. Food was brought to him upon trays, and an hour later, the trays were taken away, untouched. They gave him packages of cigarettes, but they lay on the floor, unopened. He would not even drink water. He simply lay or sat, saying nothing, not noticing when anyone entered or left his cell. When they wanted him to go from one place to another, they caught him by the wrist and led him. He went without resistance, walking always with dragging feet, head down. Even when they snatched him up by the collar, his weak body easily lending itself to be manhandled, he looked without hope or resentment, his eyes like two still pools of black ink in his flaccid face. No one had seen him, save the officials, and he had asked to see no one. Not once during the 3 days following his capture had an image of what he had done come into his mind. He had thrust the whole thing back of him, and there it lay, monstrous and horrible. He was not so much in a stupor as in the grip of a deep physiological resolution, not to react to anything. Having been thrown by an accidental murder into a position where he had sensed a possible order and meaning in his relations with the people about him, having accepted the moral guilt and responsibility for that murder because it had made him feel free for the first time in his life, having felt in his heart some obscure need to be at home with people, and having demanded ransom money to enable him to do it, having done all this and failed, he chose not to struggle anymore. With a supreme act of will, springing from the essence of his being, he turned away from his life, and the long train of disastrous consequences that had flowed from it, and looked wistfully upon the dark face of ancient waters, upon which some spirit had breathed and created him, the dark face of the waters from which he had been first made in the image of a man, with a man's obscure need and urge, feeling that he wanted to sink back into those waters and rest eternally. And yet his desire to crush all faith in him was, in itself, built upon a sense of faith. The feelings of his body reasoned that, if there could be no merging with the men and women about him, there should be a merging with some other part of the natural world in which he lived. Out of the mood of renunciation, there sprang up in him again the will to kill. But this time, it was not directed outward toward people, but inward, upon himself. Why not kill that wayward yearning within him that had led him to this end? He had reached out and killed, and had not solved anything. So why not reach inward and kill that which had duped him? This feeling sprang up of itself, organically, automatically, like the rotted hull of a seed forming the soil in which it should grow again. And, under and above it all, there was the fear of death, before which he was naked and without defense. He had to go forward and meet his end like any other living thing upon the earth. And regulating his attitude toward death was the fact that he was black, unequal, and despised. Passively, he hungered for another orbit between two poles that would let him live again, for a new mode of life that would catch him up with the tension of hate and love. There would have to hover above him, like the stars in a full sky, a vast configuration of images and symbols, whose magic and power could lift him up and make him live so intensely that the dread of being black and unequal would be forgotten, that even death would not matter, that it would be a victory. This would have to happen before he could look them in the face again. A new pride and a new humility would have to be born in him. A humility springing from a new identification with some part of the world in which he lived, and this identification forming the basis for a new hope that would function in him as pride and dignity. But maybe it would never come. Maybe there was no such thing for him. Maybe he would have to go to his end just as he was, dumb, driven, with the shadow of emptiness in his eyes. Maybe this was all. Maybe the confused promptings, the excitement, the tingling, the elation, maybe they were false lights that led nowhere. Maybe they were right when they said that a black skin was bad, the covering of an ape-like animal. Maybe he was just unlucky, a man born for dark doom. An obscene joke, happening amid a colossal din of siren screams and white faces, encircling lances of light under a cold and silken sky. But he could not feel that for long. Just as soon as his feelings reached such a conclusion, the conviction that there was some way out surged back into him, strong and powerful, and in his present state, condemning and paralyzing. And then one morning a group of men came and caught him by the wrists and led him into a large room in the Cook County morgue in which there were many people. He blinked from the bright lights and heard loud and excited talking. The compact array of white faces and the constant flashing of bulbs for pictures made him stare in mounting amazement. His defense of indifference could protect him no longer. At first, he thought that it was the trial that had begun, and he was prepared to sink back into his dream of nothingness. But it was not a courtroom. It was too informal for that. He felt crossing his feelings a sensation akin to the same one he had had when the reporters had first come into Mr. Dalton's basement with their hats on, smoking cigars and cigarettes, asking questions. Only now it was much stronger. There was in the air a silent mockery that challenged him. It was not their hate he felt. It was something deeper than that. He sensed that in their attitude toward him, they had gone beyond hate. He heard in the sound of their voices a patient certainty. He saw their eyes gazing at him with calm conviction. Though he could not have put it into words, he felt that not only had they resolved to put him to death, but that they were determined to make his death mean more than a mere punishment, that they regarded him as a figment of that black world which they feared and were anxious to keep under control. The atmosphere of the crowd told him that they were going to use his death as a bloody symbol of fear to wave before the eyes of that black world. And as he felt it, rebellion rose in him. He had sunk to the lowest point this side of death. But when he felt his life again threatened, in a way that meant that he was to go down the dark road, a helpless spectacle of sport for others, he sprang back into action, alive, contending. He tried to move his hands, and found that they were shackled by strong bands of cold steel to white wrists of policemen sitting to either side of him. He looked round. A policeman stood in front of him, and one in back. He heard a sharp metallic click, and his hands were free. There was a rising murmur of voices, and he sensed that it was caused by his movements. Then his eyes became riveted on a white face, tilted slightly upward. The skin had a quality of taut anxiety, and around the oval of white face was a framework of whiter hair. It was Mrs. Dalton, sitting quietly, her frail waxen hands folded in her lap. Bigger remembered, as he looked at her, that moment of stark terror, when he had stood at the side of the bed in the dark blue room, hearing his heart pound against his ribs with his fingers upon the pillow, pressing down upon Mary's face to keep her from mumbling. Sitting beside Mrs. Dalton was Mr. Dalton, looking straight before him with wide-open, unblinking eyes. Mr. Dalton turned slowly and looked at Bigger, and Bigger's eyes fell. He saw Jan. Blonde hair, blue eyes, a sturdy, kind face looking squarely into his own. Hot shame flooded him as the scene in the car came back. He felt again the pressure of Jan's fingers upon his hand. And then shame was replaced by guilty anger, as he recalled Jan's confronting him upon the sidewalk in the snow. He was getting tired. The more he came to himself, the more a sense of fatigue seeped into him. He looked down at his clothes. They were damp and crumpled, and the sleeves of his coat were drawn halfway up his arms. His shirt was open, and he could see the black skin of his chest. Suddenly, he felt the fingers of his right hand throb with pain. Two fingernails were torn off. He could not remember how it had happened. He tried to move his tongue and found it swollen. His lips were dry and cracked, and he wanted water. He felt giddy. The lights and faces whirled slowly like a merry-go-round. He was falling swiftly through space. When he opened his eyes, he was stretched out upon a cot. A white face loomed above him. He tried to shift his body and was pushed back.
"Take it easy, boy. Here, drink this."
A glass touched his lips. Ought he to drink? But what difference did it make? He swallowed something warm. It was milk. When the glass was empty, he lay upon his back and stared at the white ceiling. The memory of Bessie and the milk she had warmed for him came back strongly. Then the image of her death came, and he closed his eyes, trying to forget. His stomach growled. He was feeling better. He heard a low drone of voices. He gripped the edge of the cot and sat up.
"Hey, how are you feeling, boy?"
"Huh?" he grunted. It was the first time he had spoken since they had caught him.
"How are you feeling?"
He closed his eyes and turned his head away, sensing that they were white and he was black, that they were the captors and he the captive.
"He's coming out of it." "Yeah, that crowd must have got him. Say, boy, you want something to eat?"
He did not answer.
"Get him something. He doesn't know what he wants." "You better lie down, boy. You'll have to go back to the inquest this afternoon."
He felt their hands pushing him back onto the cot. The door closed. He looked round. He was alone. The room was quiet. He had come out into the world again. He had not tried to. It had just happened. He was being turned here and there by a surge of strange forces he could not understand. It was not to save his life that he had come out. He did not care what they did to him. They could place him in the electric chair right now for all he cared. It was to save his pride that he had come. He did not want them to make sport of him. If they had killed him that night, when they were dragging him down the steps, that would have been a deed born of their strength over him. But he felt they had no right to sit and watch him, to use him for whatever they wanted. The door opened, and a policeman brought in a tray of food, set it on a chair next to him, and left. There was steak and fried potatoes and coffee. Gingerly, he cut a piece of steak and put it into his mouth. It tasted so good that he tried to swallow it before he chewed it. He sat on the edge of the cot and drew the chair forward so that he could reach the food. He ate so fast that his jaws ached. He stopped and held the food in his mouth, feeling the juices of his glands flowing round it. When he was through, he lit a cigarette, stretched out upon the cot and closed his eyes. He dozed off to an uneasy sleep. Then suddenly he sat upright. He had not seen a newspaper in a long time. What were they saying now? He got up. He swayed and the room lurched. He was still weak and giddy. He leaned against the wall and walked slowly to the door. Cautiously, he turned the knob. The door swung in, and he looked into the face of a policeman.
"What's the matter, boy?"
He saw a heavy gun sagging at the man's hip. The policeman caught him by the wrist and led him back to the cot.
"Here, take it easy."
"I want a paper," he said.
"Huh? A paper?"
"I want to read the paper."
"Wait a minute, I'll see."
The policeman went out and presently returned with an armful of papers.
"Here you are, boy. You're in them all."
He did not turn to the papers until after the man had left the room. Then he spread out the Tribune and saw, "Negro rapist faints at inquest." He understood now. It was the inquest he had been taken to. He had fainted, and they had brought him here. He read,
"Overwhelmed by the sight of his accusers, Bigger Thomas, Negro sex slayer, fainted dramatically this morning at the inquest of Mary Dalton, millionaire Chicago heiress. Emerging from a stupor for the first time since his capture last Monday night, the black killer sat cowed and fearful as hundreds sought to get a glimpse of him. "He looks exactly like an ape," exclaimed a terrified young white girl who watched the black slayer being loaded onto a stretcher after he had fainted. Though the Negro killer's body does not seem compactly built, he gives the impression of possessing abnormal physical strength. He is about 5 feet 9 inches tall, and his skin is exceedingly black. His lower jaw protrudes obnoxiously, reminding one of a jungle beast. His arms are long, hanging in a dangling fashion to his knees. It is easy to imagine how this man, in the grip of a brain-numbing sex passion, overpowered little Mary Dalton, raped her, murdered her, beheaded her, then stuffed her body into a roaring furnace to destroy the evidence of his crime. His shoulders are huge, muscular, and he keeps them hunched, as if about to spring upon you at any moment. He looks at the world with a strange, sullen, fixed-from-under stare, as though defying all efforts of compassion. All in all, he seems a beast utterly untouched by the softening influences of modern civilization. In speech and manner, he lacks the charm of the average, harmless, genial, grinning southern darky so beloved by the American people. The moment the killer made his appearance at the inquest, there were shouts of, "Lynch him! Kill him!" But the brutish Negro seemed indifferent to his fate, as though inquests, trials, and even the looming certainty of the electric chair held no terror for him. He acted like an earlier missing link in the human species. He seemed out of place in a white man's civilization. An Irish police captain remarked with deep conviction, "I'm convinced that death is the only cure for the likes of him." For 3 days, the Negro has refused all nourishment. Police believe that he is either trying to starve himself to death and cheat the chair, or that he is trying to excite sympathy for himself. From Jackson, Mississippi, came a report yesterday from Edward Robertson, editor of the Jackson Daily Star, regarding Bigger Thomas's boyhood there. The editor wired, "Thomas comes of a poor, darky family of a shiftless and immoral variety. He was raised here and is known to local residents as an irreformable sneak thief and liar. We were unable to send him to the chain gang because of his extreme youth. Our experience here in Dixie with such depraved types of Negroes has shown that only the death penalty, inflicted in a public and dramatic manner, has any influence upon their peculiar mentality. Had that nigger Thomas lived in Mississippi and committed such a crime, no power under heaven could have saved him from death at the hands of indignant citizens. I think it proper to inform you that in many quarters it is believed that Thomas, despite his dead black complexion, may have a minor portion of white blood in his veins, a mixture which generally makes for a criminal and intractable nature. Down here in Dixie, we keep Negroes firmly in their places, and we make them know that if they so much as touch a white woman, good or bad, they cannot live. When Negroes become resentful over imagined wrongs, nothing brings them to their senses so quickly as when citizens take the law into their hands and make an example out of a troublemaking nigger. Crimes such as the Bigger Thomas murders could be lessened by segregating all Negroes in parks, playgrounds, cafes, theaters, and streetcars. Residential segregation is imperative. Such measures tend to keep them as much as possible out of direct contact with white women and lessen their attacks against them. We of the South believe that the North encourages Negroes to get more education than they are organically capable of absorbing, with the result that Northern Negroes are generally more unhappy and restless than those of the South. If separate schools were maintained, it would be fairly easy to limit the Negroes' education by regulating the appropriation of monies through city, county, and state legislative bodies. Still, another psychological deterrent can be attained by conditioning Negroes so that they have to pay deference to the white person with whom they come in contact. This is done by regulating their speech and actions. We have found that the injection of an element of constant fear has aided us greatly in handling the problem."
He lowered the paper. He could not read any more. Yes, of course they were going to kill him. But they were having this sport with him before they did it. He held very still. He was trying to make a decision. Not thinking, but feeling it out. Ought he to go back behind his wall? Could he go back now? He felt that he could not. But would not any effort he made now turn out like the others? Why go forward and meet more hate? He lay on the cot, feeling as he had felt that night when his fingers had gripped the icy edges of the water tank, under the roving flares of light, knowing that men crouched below him with guns and tear gas, hearing the screams of sirens and shouts rising thirstily from 10,000 throats. Overcome with drowsiness, he closed his eyes, then opened them abruptly. The door swung in, and he saw a black face. Who was this? A tall, well-dressed black man came forward and paused. Bigger pulled up and leaned on his elbow. The man came all the way to the cot and stretched forth a dingy palm, touching Bigger's hand.
My poor boy, may the good Lord have mercy on you.
He stared at the man's jet-black suit and remembered who he was. Reverend Hammond, the pastor of his mother's church. And at once he was on guard against the man. He shut his heart and tried to stifle all feeling in him. He feared that the preacher would make him feel remorseful. He wanted to tell him to go. But so closely associated in his mind was the man with his mother, and what she stood for, that he could not speak. In his feelings he could not tell the difference between what this man evoked in him and what he had read in the papers. The love of his own kind and the hate of others made him feel equally guilty now.
How you feel, son?
The man asked. He did not answer, and the man's voice hurried on.
Your ma asked me to come and see you. She wants to come, too.
The preacher knelt upon the concrete floor and closed his eyes. Bigger clamped his teeth and flexed his muscles. He knew what was coming.
Lord Jesus, turn your eyes and look into the heart of this poor sinner. You said mercy was always yours, and if we asked for it on bended knee, you'd pour it out into our hearts and make our cups run over. We asked in you to pour out your mercy now, Lord. Pour it for this poor sinner boy who stands in deep need of it. If his sins be as scarlet, Lord, wash them white as snow. Forgive him for whatever he's done, Lord. Let the light of your love guide him through these dark days. And help them who's a-trying to help him, Lord. Enter into their hearts and breathe compassion on their spirits. We ask this in the name of your son, Jesus, who died on the cross and gave us the mercy of your love. Amen.
Bigger stared unblinkingly at the white wall before him as the preacher's words registered themselves in his consciousness. He knew without listening what they meant. It was the old voice of his mother telling of suffering, of hope, of love beyond this world. And he loathed it because it made him feel as condemned and guilty as the voice of those who hated him.
Son?
Bigger glanced at the preacher and then away.
Forget everything but your soul, son. Take your mind off everything but eternal life. Forget what the newspapers say. Forget yours black. God looks past your skin and into your soul, son. He's looking at the only part of you that's his. He wants you, and he loves you. Give yourself to him, son. Listen, let me tell you why he's here. Let me tell you a story that'll make your heart glad.
Bigger sat very still, listening and not listening. If someone had afterwards asked him to repeat the preacher's words, he would not have been able to do so. But he felt and sensed their meaning. As the preacher talked, there appeared before him a vast black silent void, and the images of the preacher swam in that void, grew large and powerful. Familiar images which his mother had given him when he was a child at her knee. Images which in turn aroused impulses long dormant. Impulses that he had suppressed and sought to shunt from his life. They were images which had once given him a reason for living, had explained the world. Now they sprawled before his eyes and seized his emotions in a spell of awe and wonder. an endless reach of deep murmuring waters upon whose face was darkness, and there was no form, no shape, no sun, no stars, and no land. And a voice came out of the darkness, and the waters moved to obey. And there emerged slowly a huge spinning ball. And the voice said, Let there be light. And there was light, and it was good light. And the voice said, Let there be a firmament. And the waters parted, and there was a vast space over the waters, which formed into clouds, stretching above the waters. And like an echo the voice came from far away, saying, Let dry land appear. And with thundering rustling the waters drained off, and mountain peaks reared into view, and there were valleys and rivers, and the voice called the dry land earth, and the waters seas, and the earth grew grass and trees and flowers that gave off seed that fell to the earth to grow again. And the earth was lit by the light of a million stars, and for the day there was a sun, and for the night there was a moon, and there were days and weeks and months and years. And the voice called out of the twilight, and moving creatures came forth out of the great waters, whales, and all kinds of living creeping things. And on the land there were beasts and cattle. And the voice said, Let us make man in our own image. And from the dusty earth a man rose up, and loomed against the day and the sun. And after him a woman rose up, and loomed against the night and the moon. And they lived as one flesh, and there was no pain, no longing, no time, no death. And life was like the flowers that bloomed round them in the garden of earth. And out of the clouds came a voice saying, Eat not of the fruit of the tree in the midst of the garden, neither touch it, lest ye die. The preacher's words ceased droning. Bigger looked at him out of the corners of his eyes. The preacher's face was black and sad and earnest, and made him feel a sense of guilt deeper than that which even his murder of Mary had made him feel. He had killed, within himself, the preacher's haunting picture of life, even before he had killed Mary. That had been his first murder. And now the preacher made it walk before his eyes like a ghost in the night, creating within him a sense of exclusion that was as cold as a block of ice. Why should this thing rise now to plague him, after he had pressed a pillow of fear and hate over its face to smother it to death? To those who wanted to kill him, he was not human, not included in that picture of creation. And that was why he had killed it, to live. He had created a new world for himself, and for that, he was to die. Again, the preacher's words seeped into his feelings. Son, you know what the tree was? It was the tree of knowledge. It wasn't enough for man to be like God. He wanted to know why. And all God wanted him to do was bloom like the flowers in the fields, live as children. Man wanted to know why, and he fell from light to darkness, from love to damnation, from blessedness to shame. And God cast him out of the garden and told a man he had to get his bread by the sweat of his brow, and told a woman she had to bring forth her children in pain and sorrow. The world turned against him, and they had to fight the world for life. The man and the woman walked fearfully among the trees, their hands covering their nakedness, and back of them, high in the twilight against the clouds, an angel waved a flaming sword, driving them out of the garden into the wild night of cold wind and tears and pain and death. And the man and the woman took their food and burnt it to send smoke to the sky, begging forgiveness. Son, for thousands of years, we've been praying for God to take that cuss off us. God heard our prayers and said he'd show us a way back to him. His son Jesus came down to earth and put on human flesh and lived and died to show us the way. Jesus let men crucify him, but his death was a victory. He showed us that to live in this world was to be crucified by it. This world ain't our home. Life every day is a crucifixion. There ain't but one way out, son, and that's Jesus' way, the way of love and forgiveness. Be like Jesus. Don't resist. Thank God that he done chose this way for you to come to him. It's love that's got to save you, son. You got to believe that God gives eternal life through the love of Jesus. Son, look at me.
Bigger's black face rested in his hands, and he did not move. Son, promise me you'll stop hating long enough for God's love to come into your heart. Bigger said nothing. Won't you promise me, son? Bigger covered his eyes with his hands. Just say you'll try, son. Bigger felt that if the preacher kept asking, he would leap up and strike him. How could he believe in that which he had killed? He was guilty. The preacher rose, sighed, and drew from his pocket a small wooden cross with a chain upon it. Look, son, I'm holding in my hands a wooden cross taken from a tree. A tree is the world, son, and nailed to this tree is a suffering man. That's what life is, son, suffering. How can you keep from believing the word of God when I'm holding before your eyes the only thing that gives a meaning to your life? Here, let me put it around your neck. When you get alone, look at this cross, son, and believe.
They were silent. The wooden cross hung next to the skin of Bigger's chest. He was feeling the words of the preacher, feeling that life was flesh nailed to the world, a longing spirit imprisoned in the days of the earth. He glanced up, hearing the doorknob turn. The door opened, and Jan stood framed in it, hesitating. Bigger sprang to his feet, galvanized by fear. The preacher also stood, took a step backward, bowed, and said,
Good morning, sir.
Bigger wondered what Jan could want of him now. Was he not caught and ready for trial? Would not Jan get his revenge? Bigger stiffened as Jan walked to the middle of the floor and stood facing him. Then it suddenly occurred to Bigger that he need not be standing, that he had no reason to fear bodily harm from Jan here in jail. He sat and bowed his head. The room was quiet. So quiet that Bigger heard the preacher and Jan breathing. The white man upon whom he had tried to blame his crime stood before him, and he sat waiting to hear angry words. Well, why didn't he speak? He lifted his eyes. Jan was looking straight at him, and he looked away. But Jan's face was not angry. If he were not angry, then what did he want? He looked again and saw Jan's lips move to speak, but no words came. And when Jan did speak, his voice was low, and there were long pauses between the words. It seemed to Bigger that he was listening to a man talk to himself. Bigger? Maybe I haven't the words to say what I want to say, but I'm going to try. This thing hit me like a bomb. It took me all week to get myself together. They had me in jail, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out what was happening. I don't want to worry you, Bigger. I know you're in trouble. But there's something I just got to say. You needn't talk to me unless you want to, Bigger. I think I know something of what you're feeling now. I'm not dumb, Bigger. I can understand, even if I didn't seem to understand that night.
Jan paused, swallowed, and lit a cigarette.
Well, you jarred me. I see now. I was kind of blind. I just wanted to come here and tell you that I'm not angry. I'm not angry, and I want you to let me help you. I don't hate you for trying to blame this thing on me. Maybe you had good reasons. I don't know. And maybe in a certain sense, I'm the one who's really guilty. Jan paused again, and sucked long and hard at his cigarette, blew the smoke out slowly, and nervously bit his lips. Bigger, I've never done anything against you and your people in my life. But I'm a white man, and it would be asking too much to ask you not to hate me, when every white man you see hates you. I know my face looks like theirs to you, even though I don't feel like they do. But I didn't know we were so far apart until that night. I can understand now why you pulled that gun on me when I waited outside that house to talk to you. It was the only thing you could have done. But I didn't know my white face was making you feel guilty, condemning you. Jan's lips hung open, but no words came from them. His eyes searched the corners of the room. Bigger sat silently, bewildered, feeling that he was on a vast, blind wheel being turned by stray gusts of wind. The preacher came forward.
Is your Mr. Erlong?
Yes, said Jan, turning.
That was a mighty fine thing you just said, sir. If anybody needs help, this poor boy sure does. I'm Reverend Hammond.
Bigger saw Jan and the preacher shake hands. Though this thing hurt me, I got something out of it, Jan said, sitting down and turning to Bigger. It made me see deeper into men. It made me see things I knew, but had forgotten. I lost something, but I got something too. Jan tugged at his tie, and the room was silent, waiting for him to speak. It taught me that it's your right to hate me, Bigger. I see now that you couldn't do anything else but that. It was all you had. But Bigger, if I say you got the right to hate me, then that ought to make things a little different, oughtn't it? Ever since I got out of jail, I've been thinking this thing over, and I felt that I'm the one who ought to be in jail for murder instead of you. But that can't be, Bigger. I can't take upon myself the blame for what 100 million people have done. Jan leaned forward and stared at the floor. I'm not trying to make up to you, Bigger. I didn't come here to feel sorry for you. I don't suppose you're so much worse off than the rest of us who get tangled up in this world. I'm here because I'm trying to live up to this thing as I see it. And it isn't easy, Bigger. I loved that girl you killed. I loved. His voice broke, and Bigger saw his lips tremble. I was in jail grieving for Mary, and then I thought of all the black men who've been killed, the black men who had to grieve when their people were snatched from them in slavery and since slavery. I thought that if they could stand it, then I ought to. Jan crushed the cigarette with his shoe. At first, I thought old man Dalton was trying to frame me, and I wanted to kill him. And when I heard that you'd done it, I wanted to kill you. And then I got to thinking. I saw if I killed, this thing would go on and never stop. I said, I'm going to help that guy, if he lets me.
May God in heaven bless you, son, the preacher said.
Jan lit another cigarette and offered one to Bigger, but Bigger refused by keeping his hands folded in front of him and staring stonily at the floor. Jan's words were strange. He had never heard such talk before. The meaning of what Jan had said was so new that he could not react to it. He simply sat, staring, wondering, afraid even to look at Jan. Let me be on your side, Bigger, Jan said. I can fight this thing with you, just like you've started it. I can come from all those white people and stand here with you. Listen, I got a friend, a lawyer. His name is Max. He understands this thing and wants to help you. Won't you talk to him? Bigger understood that Jan was not holding him guilty for what he had done. Was this a trap? He looked at Jan and saw a white face, but an honest face. This white man believed in him, and the moment he felt that belief, he felt guilty again, but in a different sense now. Suddenly, this white man had come up to him, flung aside the curtain, and walked into the room of his life. Jan had spoken a declaration of friendship that would make other white men hate him. A particle of white rock had detached itself from that looming mountain of white hate and had rolled down the slope, stopping still at his feet. The word had become flesh. For the first time in his life, a white man became a human being to him, and the reality of Jan's humanity came in a stab of remorse. He had killed what this man loved, and had hurt him. He saw Jan as though someone had performed an operation upon his eyes, or as though someone had snatched a deforming mask from Jan's face. Bigger started nervously. The preacher's hand came to his shoulder.
I don't want to break in and meddle where I ain't got no business, sir,
the preacher said in a tone that was militant, but deferring.
But they ain't no use of dragging no communism in this thing, mister. I respects your feelings powerfully, sir, but what you's asking just stirs up more hate. What this poor boy needs is understanding.
But he's got to fight for it, Jan said.
I'm with you when you want to change men's hearts, the preacher said. But I can't go with you when you want to stir up more hate.
Bigger sat looking from one to the other, bewildered.
How on earth are you going to change men's hearts when the newspapers are fanning hate into them every day? Jan asked.
God can change them, the preacher said fervently.
Jan turned to Bigger. Won't you let my friend help you, Bigger? Bigger's eyes looked round the room, as if seeking a means of escape. What could he say? He was guilty. Forgive me, he mumbled.
I can't, Jan said.
It's over for me, Bigger said.
Don't you believe in yourself?
No, Bigger whispered tensely.
You believed enough to kill. You thought you were settling something, or you wouldn't have killed, Jan said.
Bigger stared and did not answer. Did this man believe in him that much?
I want you to talk to Max, Jan said.
Jan went to the door. A policeman opened it from the outside. Bigger sat open-mouthed, trying to feel where all this was bearing him. He saw a man's head come into the door. A head strange and white, with silver hair and a lean white face that he had never seen before.
Come on in, Jan said.
Thanks. The voice was quiet, firm, but kind. There was about the man's thin lips a faint smile that seemed to have always been there. The man stepped inside. He was tall.
How are you, Bigger?
Bigger did not answer. He was doubtful again. Was this a trap of some kind?
This is Reverend Hammond, Max, Jan said.
Max shook hands with the preacher, then turned to Bigger.
I want to talk with you, Max said. I'm from the Labor Defenders. I want to help you.
I ain't got no money, Bigger said.
I know that. Listen, Bigger, don't be afraid of me. And don't be afraid of Jan. We're not angry with you. I want to represent you in court. Have you spoken to any other lawyer?
Bigger looked at Jan and Max again. They seemed all right. But how on earth could they help him? He wanted help, but dared not think that anybody would want to do anything for him now.
No, sir, he whispered.
How have they treated you? Did they beat you?
I've been sick, Bigger said, knowing that he had to explain why he had not spoken or eaten in 3 days. I've been sick and I don't know.
Are you willing to let us handle your case?
I ain't got no money.
Forget about that.
Listen, they're taking you back to the inquest this afternoon. But you don't have to answer any questions, see? Just sit and say nothing. I'll be there and you won't have to be scared. After the inquest, they'll take you to the Cook County Jail, and I'll be over to talk with you.
Yes, sir.
Here, take these cigarettes.
Thank you, sir.